First scene I ever shot was in the prison cell, and we had Aaron Eckhart, we had Chris Nolan, we had Gary Oldman on the first day, and I was like, gosh, you know, I mean, I have no idea what these guys are thinking. Not sure if they are.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
Okay, here we go, back again, another episode of Story and Craft. And you're here for it, so thank you. My name is Mark, and if this is your first time popping into the pod, as they say, or maybe they don't say, I said it, whatever. Thank you. Thank you for checking out the show. Today, we have a great episode, sitting down with very talented actor Chin Han. You know him from movies like Mortal Kombat, The Dark Knight, Contagion, American-Born Chinese, and of course, Avatar, The Last Airbender, Season 2 on Netflix as we speak. And it was a great conversation. Really enjoyed talking about his journey from Singapore to being in blockbusters. Really cool guy. Really enjoyed it. And do me a favor, if you would, make sure to follow Story and Craft. You know, just grab your podcast app, or we'll grab your phone, which I guess has the podcast app on it. Follow the show, leave a review, like it, like the show. I mean, it really does help people to find Story and Craft, and doggone it, I appreciate it. Also, everything you could possibly want to know about the show, past guests, past episodes, just go to storyandcraftpod.com. It's all right there. Okay, so let's jump right into it, because today is Chin Han Day, right now on Story and Craft. Good to have you, my friend. Where are you joining me from today?
I'm joining you from L.A.
Now, how long you live there? I know you're from Singapore originally, but how long have you been living stateside here?
I've been stateside since The Dark Knight, actually, which was 2007. The work has taken me far and wide. As you probably know, a lot of things are shot here. So, yeah, it's been a lot of travel in the last 19 years. Hard to believe, even.
How long of a flight is it to Singapore from where you are?
Well, nonstop, I think, will be about 16 and a half hours. Nonstop. I think with a stop, and usually it's in Tokyo, that would be 18 to 20.
I'm very enamored with the idea of Singapore, and folks that listen to my show know I brought it up many times, but Anthony Bourdain, I'm a big fan, and he loved Singapore. It was the hawker markets that they have there with all the different places to eat. I'm like, oh my God, that's a wonderland. I got to check that out. But when you were growing up in Singapore, it seems like they went through a tremendous amount of growth kind of in the last 20, 30 years. It just kind of exploded. What was it like when you were growing up there?
Well, it's interesting because Singapore got independence in the 60s, and I was born in 69. So I got to see a lot of the development through the 70s and 80s and 90s. I mean, most of the people I know Singapore from, you know, from most recently the movies like Crazy Rich Asians, or even more recently, I think the Formula One races. I mean, they've taken to hosting quite big global events there. So that is the Singapore that a lot of people know. You know, that is modern, developed, affluent. But it was very interesting to see Singapore in the 70s and 80s. I mean, I think that
it was a very big, like, master planned exponential growth kind of a thing. It seems like there are a lot of rules of how things operate, but it's very clean, very efficient. And there's it's a very interesting study in civic development, you know.
Civic development, I think, engineering, I think, of a society. I think that's all part of a big master plan, obviously, and that we felt all of that, right, in the 70s and 80s. 90s was a fun time for me because that was actually effectively when I started my career. But in the 70s and 80s, my education in film and theater were very, let's just say, specific to the country. There were movies that were censored for for cultural sensitivities, I think, as well, because, I mean, there's just so many ethnic races in a country like that. And I think it was a country that was small enough for us to take all those sensitivities into consideration and to be able to kind of...
That's one of the things I noticed about it. It seems like that you have a lot of different kind of cultures blending. It's not a friction based on, you know, your culture, religion, whatever have you. It's very like respect and you'll be respected kind of thing.
As a child, that was wonderful because going to school, you'll get all the holidays, right? You get Hari Raya, you got Thai Pusam, Visak Day, Christmas. We celebrated all the holidays of all the different ethnicities.
I'm curious though, like you came into this and you're coming, like, I think kind of the golden era of Singapore coming into its own. It was cool for you, but what were your folks doing? What was their vocation as you were coming up?
I think it should come as no surprise that my parents were both educationists. They were teachers. I think that accounts for how open-minded they were. And obviously, coming from Asia, the focus generally is on other kinds of professions for their children, right? I mean, I think mm-hmm. being a doctor, being a banker, being a lawyer, those things were very sought after in the time that I was growing up. But, you know, I was always in love with the movies, even from a very, very young age. So I would say that, you know, my education from movies in the 70s was huge. I also think that because we were at the confluence of all the different countries, right? I mean, of all the different trade that was going through the countries.
Right.
To the country, I think we were a colonial country at some point. So a lot of the television and film that we were getting at one point was very British, and then the American movies started coming in.
Isn't Singapore? Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it like the biggest, if not the biggest transshipment point for shipping in the world? I think,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it goes back and forth between Amsterdam and Singapore for number one, I think. There is a lot of shipping trade, and, you know, and so it also wasn't a surprise that the first English language TV series that I did in 94, I believe, was actually a soap about shipping families. So... Yeah, because it's such a big thing, right? It's such a big...
Well, I'm curious, what were you watching? What was the movies and the film and that was maybe more Western, like from the U.S.? What was coming up that was grabbing your attention?
So this was very interesting because, I mean, what started out with a lot of British shows, right? That, like sitcoms like Mind Your Language, I would say even Fawlty Towers, Blackadder... And then some of the more serious shows like Crown Court, Brideshead Revisited, with Jeremy Irons, obviously. I mean, that was back in the day. That stuff
Did Benny Hill figure in at all? Were you into comedy?
Benny Hill was a bit too raunchy, I think, for Singapore at the time. So you know, I think that was what we got. And then slowly the American TV shows started coming, things like... Happy Days, you know, Knight Rider. It was very interesting because as a child, I really liked reading, and I liked the more literary kind of television material as well. But then when the American stuff started coming, that stuff was, you know, undeniable because it was so interesting. I mean, you had a car that could talk. You have the Fonz in Happy Days. You have... Airwolf, you have Miami Vice.
Oh, Airwolf, yeah. Yeah. That was this very specific time. That was, you know, all the stuff was, I would say, generally cool for, you know, kids to watch. Airwolf, A-Team, you know, things like that. But we had a big selection and everybody was watching the same thing. That was the kind of, we only had like three, you know, networks, you know.
But you had a lot of diversity in terms of the programming too, right? Because I remember Moonlighting being very, very interesting. Also, for me, I think the comedies for me, I thought were hilarious, were things like Taxi, Cheers, basically, as well.
Yeah.
So that stuff was, yeah, that stuff came in and was gangbusters. And I think
now, did y'all get it when it came out? Because I know that some things, you know, there's kind of a delay before it actually gets its international release. Mm-hmm. Were you getting it pretty much the same time it was airing in the U.S.?
No. I believe we didn't get it at the same time as the U.S. So obviously, I mean, it was very exciting when you had friends or relatives or cousins who had gone to the U.S. and they come back and they tell you like, oh, this is what happens. After this is, you know, this is the stuff that is that happens to so and so. But, you know, on top of that, what made my education in cinema and television, I think, interesting was also on top of that, we had a lot of Chinese TV serials that were coming from Hong Kong. Right. So So we had those epic martial arts novels, TV shows that were
Jackie Chan came from Hong Kong.
Yes,
right? Okay.
So Jackie Chan, Sammo Hung, all the young, you know, they were so young at that time, and Donnie Yen was even younger. Was even later than that. So you can imagine how early that was. There was the Hui brothers, and they were doing movies for Golden Harvest and Shaw Brothers, right? So we were getting all of that on top of everything else. I mean, I love that stuff as much, right? I love the serialized.
Was Hong Kong, was the Chinese that you were getting from Hong Kong? That was different than mainland China, because Hong Kong was its own ecosystem. Yes. Yeah, I have my grandfather did a lot of business in Hong Kong. Every 6 months to a year, he would travel there, and he had things manufactured. He'd always have a suit made every time he went to Hong Kong, and get these stories of just, it just seemed like this magical place I always wanted to visit. In fact, on my desk here, I've got a little thing his business partner gave him that, you know, when he passed, it's the business that was done there. Was Singapore very culturally was it similar kind of to Hong Kong? And it's, you know what I'm saying? Was there a little bit, of course, it's a little, not restrictive in some, they're more mindful of certain things, but it mm-hmm. seems like it's a very pro-business kind of arts kind of a vibe. Would that be an accurate assessment?
I think so, because, I mean, the history is kind of similar too, right? I mean, we were also a colonial country. So, like, the most popular thing, one of the most popular things to do in Hong Kong is to go to the Peninsula Hotel to have high tea, right? So that is very, that is customary. In that respect, I think there are similarities, but Singapore is also further south. In Asia, and we, you know, the population, I think, is less homogenous. I mean, we have a very vibrant Malay community, an Indian community, a Eurasian community, and what we call the Peranakan community, which is a Singaporean kind of a mix of a lot of the different cultures, and then we have our own kind of culture with our own kind of cuisine. So there are some similarities, but Singapore is, I think, a little different because it's less homogenous with the Chinese population.
As a kid growing up, did you feel that you had kind of the, you know, freedom to kind of go into the arts, or were your folks kind of mm-hmm. angling you in a direction of like, hey, you know, something that has a nice business card? Or were you feeling like, hey, the arts are cool?
Well, I mean, I was interested, and they always, you know, supported it. I mean, they kind of nourished my interest very much, because my mom herself is a movie lover. So I grew up with a lot of information on her favorite stars and movies of the past. And so when we were growing up in the 70s, when Singapore was going through industrialization, we would go to the cinemas a lot, and they were very, very kind of open with me in terms of the movies that I was interested in. So I could ask them to take me to a James Bond movie, or I could ask them to take me to Star Wars, or even The Exorcist, or Jaws, and they would, of course, you know, I mean, preface any of these movies by telling me, you know, it's a horror movie, it's make-believe, it's okay. Right. And so I got very used to seeing a lot of different kinds of movies when I was growing up. And I think that was very, very helpful.
Was there anything that ever, any film or any actor that was like a Mount Rushmore for you, where you're like, oh man, that just a spark for you? That's like, I want to do film, maybe even something on stage, you know? I mean, was there a pull to wanting to be on the big screen? Was that the thing for you? Or?
It was a very interesting time because, you know, I think Singapore, the film industry in Singapore was in its nascent stages. I mean, it's nowhere, you know, at that point in the 70s and 80s, nowhere close to what was happening in Hong Kong, where, you know, so much, there was such a great volume of movies and TV shows that were coming out of it. So the theater scene at that time was also young, but very interesting. But of course, I mean, I was too young to, be aware of what was happening in the theater scene at that point. I think what was most accessible was the movies. I mean, you pay a certain amount of money, you go to the theater and you get lost in there for 2 hours. I do remember certain movies that were just visceral, that had me gripped viscerally. I think The Godfather was one of them, and it was so operatic. It wasn't very different from the kind of movies that, you know, that the Chinese were in Hong Kong were producing, you know, that kind of big operatic, even melodramatic kind of themes and portrayals of family and revenge. So I think that was very, that movie was very striking for me. I think Pacino's performance was incredible. But then I also was very won over by the whimsical movies like The Sting. Right, I remember.
Those are some heavyweights in that. These are guys that made it look easy. You know, they did seem to have effortlessness, you know.
They did. And then, you know, came the blockbusters, right? I mean, the late 70s came the blockbusters. Then Star Wars just kind of blew me away. And then Jaws was very, very exciting, was also very exciting for me. And so I think for me, the Mount Rushmore, I think these were the guys that were actually doing it. Roy Scheider was a hero of mine for the longest time.
Yeah. Do you remember Blue Thunder? Remember that movie with the helicopter and like that? Oh, I love that movie. So when I was a kid, I was like, that's like 1984, I think.
John Badham was like the, you know, he was making all these incredible movies like War Games, Saturday Night Fever, Blue Thunder.
Oh, yeah. You said John Badham?
Yeah, John Badham.
It was a special era. I think it's even special era for if you were a kid at that time, because, you know, there was always something big. Kind of talking about some of your work, I'm trying to remember. It was Contagion. Yeah. I know you're in that, but I'm having a difficult time placing. Where did you fall into Contagion? I thought that because it's been a while since I've seen it.
Well, I fall into there are three threads, I think, mainly. One is the one that takes place in America. That's the one with Matt Damon. And I think the other thread was the Jude Law thread, which was about the misinformation and disinformation. And then the third thread was...
Was that the one where you're trying to get the for your... village, yes. You're trying to get the vaccine.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
It's a storyline with Marion Cotillard.
There you go. Yeah, yeah.
And so that one was interesting. I mean, we shot a lot of footage from there. I think the first cut of Contagion was about 3 hours long. It was a massive undertaking for Scott Z. Burns. I think that was a thick screenplay, and you know, I mean, we shot a lot of it, but I think what Steven had decided to do at the end of the day was he needed a movie that moved as quickly as the virus, I think, and so he cut it down to a 1 hour, I think 45-minute movie.
There was kind of a kinetic pace to that movie, and I think that really, and I rewatched it with, I think my son and I rewatched it during COVID, or right. Somewhere just on the tail end of COVID, I think. And I was like, man, it really resonated. Like, well, this was a little on point, you know. But Soderbergh, I know I've seen him where he shoots stuff a lot himself. Was this film kind of like that, where he had the camera and he was doing most of it?
I love it. I mean, he's also his own DP, right? So,
yeah.
So it's wonderful working. It's very, organic. And I feel like even though Contagion was such a big budget movie with so many stars, right? I think there were like at least five Academy Award winners in that movie. I felt like we were shooting guerrilla style. We were also shooting in Hong Kong for that. I mean, to talk about Hong Kong being an incredible venue for filmmaking, because the architecture of the city and landscape of the city is so dynamic and so interesting. We were shooting in some of the busiest streets, like neighborhoods like Mong Kok, or we had found a place to double for the airport too. So we were running around the entire city. We were shooting on a floating casino that doesn't even, that I don't think is there anymore. But it's very fun. So it feels like you're shooting kind of an art house movie with him, guerrilla style. And then at the end of the day, after all is said and done, when he's got his shot and he's sitting in the hotel lobby editing it on his computer with his editor or his producers.
Really?
In the lobby of the hotel, in the restaurant of the hotel. It's quite a trip.
I thought Contagion was just great. And I did like the way they broke it into different storylines, because it does, and it really kind of gave the sense not only how it affects different people, but different parts of the world, And that was, when you look at that, they talk about, social distancing and all those things became just, daily phrases during COVID, it was really interesting. And he always did his sound mixing at a studio in New Orleans, and I'd shot something there and I had to go do an ADR session. And I was not really paying attention to anything. This engineer was in a different room, but I look on the table in front of me, and it was Ocean's 12. The whole screenplay was sitting there. And I asked the guy, like, what's this all about? He's like, oh, he does all of his mixing here. And, that movie wasn't out yet, and I was so tempted to kind of thumb through it, But, he's such a talented guy, and I think he just nailed it. Your part in it was, very interesting, because it kind of boiled down to, you were, I think, working with one of the agencies or with them, and you kind of all came down to like, I got to take care of my people, yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, they just gave you all a placebo. They didn't even give you all the real, the village, the real thing, I don't think, as far as vaccine.
Yes, they gave us a placebo, and Marion's character actually is quite a heroic one as well, because we develop a relationship in the course of the film, and you don't see all of that though. I mean, we have shot the stuff, it's in the script, and she offers herself up as a hostage and to trade for the vaccines. And of course, I mean, the tragedy of it all was that the vaccines were placebos. But it is interesting. I mean, I got so much out of that film. It was kind of prescient at that point, but I mean, to this day, I'm still friends with the consultant on the movie, Dr. Ian Lipkin, who's one of the foremost virologists in the world. So, I mean, that's been quite an experience. I think it was a really worthwhile experience.
Hey, I'm Andy from the Ultimate Trivia Podcast.
The Ultimate Trivia Podcast.
Our show is pretty simple. Five lifelong friends competing on a single topic to see who gets bragging rights. Each episode, Nick, Scott, Brian, Kelly, and I battle through 10 questions on movies, music, science, history, sports, whatever we decide to throw in the blender for that week. Every episode stands on its own, so you can jump in wherever your curiosity takes you. And we don't just stop at right or wrong. We get into the backstory, the origins, the weird facts, and the stuff that has you saying, how did I not know that already? So download an episode, play along, keep score, and tell us how you do. See if you can beat the crew on the Ultimate Trivia Podcast.
When you kind of segueing in, and I'm not just going down your resume, but things like when I told my son, I was talking to him, he's like, oh, I saw him in Mortal Kombat, with the different genres of movies out there, talking about Mortal Kombat or the Airbender, do you have a certain magnetism towards a certain genre or a certain type of work that kind of brings you joy, or do you like jumping into just kind of whatever comes your way?
I like jumping into many things. I mean, it kind of mirrors my interest in movies, right? I mean, I think when I was a young person, you know, I would be first in line to see Raiders of the Lost Ark, but I would also be asking my folks to take me to Sophie's Choice, right? So
really.
Yeah,
that's kind of a heavy movie for a kid.
I know. I didn't quite understand all of it. It was very interesting because, I mean, I would be like, okay, I want to see Reds. Also didn't quite understand what that movie was about. I was a kid at the time. But then I want to see Empire Strikes Back. And then I want to see, then I saw Gone in 60 Seconds, you know, the 70s version of that.
Right.
I wanted to see all the Bond movies. But at the same time, you know, I was very drawn to things like broadcast news, terms of endearment, you know, things like that, Passage to India, the David Lean stuff, Chariots of Fire. So in terms of my choices, in terms of the movies that I actually choose to do, I think it kind of reflects that just a very, very, you know, passionate kind of love for film, I think.
The Avatar, The Last Airbender, that's, from what I understand, that's kind of celebrating the Asian culture. That's really just kind of wired in. In fact, I talked to Ken Lung not too long ago. And, you know, one guy, Daniel Day Kim, I think I always say that guy's in way too good a shape. You know, he makes me, every time I see him, I'm like, I got to get to the gym. Being in America, do you feel, and I'm going to kind of go off in a serious direction, but do you feel that there is good representation of culturally, or do you think it's a little more of a theatrical representation of the cultural notes like you grew up with? You know, or hopefully I'm framing that in a way that makes sense, but do you think that they're properly paying homage to the culture?
Well, you know, I mean, there's always the discussion with tokenism or some kind of reductive representation. I think that's what you were referring to. I think the efforts that all the Asian American and Asian talents, I mean, are now focused on are twofold, right? I think there is one aspect of it to get the quantity of roles up, and that is a very real fight, and that's a very real effort.
And then, you're talking about the volume of movies,
the volume of actors, Asian actors in film and television, so that there is that a quantity. And then, you know, for lack of a better word, quality, right? I mean, authenticity, things that we want to, that, you know, we feel resonates in a real way and tells our stories in a real way that is helpful. Right, I mean, for society to be more empathetic or to understand each other better, so that, you know, the potential for conflict is less. So it's twofold, right? I mean, on the one hand, we need to try to get the volume up, and on the other, we need to get the representation right. Sometimes they overlap, sometimes they don't. But, you know, I think that is what we continue to work with. I think in recent years, though, I mean, if you look at the stuff that has been coming up, like Interior Chinatown or even American Born Chinese, which, you know, I really enjoy working on based on the graphic novel that Jin Leung Yang had written about Chinese families, about immigrant families, about second generation Asian.
Yeah, that's the thing that fascinates me, being second generation, especially when your parents had certain aspirations, goals, and reason why they may have people's parents for coming to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And what's that cultural experience like? Like, I'll go back to Anthony Bourdain, which I just loved watching him. He's talking about, like, the Korean culture, you know, the way that parents raise the children is very similar. So they talk about, you know, punishment and things like that. It's sort of the cultural notes, but they're naturally different depending on where somebody's family came from.
The challenges are different. I think where you're in a place where you are the majority, for example, which I grew up, the challenges facing my Asian American compatriots, I think, are a little different. So, you know, it's been very interesting in the last 19 years being here too. I mean, just getting to understand the sensitivities and the things that my Asian American actors and friends have to navigate, I mean, are it's very eye opening.
I think so. But we're also living through kind of a peculiar moment in the American experience. You know, it's where some things you go, oh, we're back to dealing with this nonsense again. I thought we kind of closed the door on that. But I think coming from Singapore, we're sort of like, hey, the general idea is, from what I understand, the way I interpret it is, hey, we're all here. Don't give anybody a hard time about, you know, it's very out of vogue to have any issue based on culture, religion, race, whatever. But to come here, when you first got in and you started working, what was your experience like? What were at first blush, kind of what was your first, oh, I'm here now, I'm doing a thing, and this is the first experience. What was that like?
I think the reach of the American film is like no other. I mean, it's if you're in an American blockbuster movie, the kind of reach that kind of movie gives you is really quite astounding. I mean, before The Dark Knight opened, to see that the response coming from Europe or Asia or, you know, or the US or North America or South America, Central America. I mean, the thing is, the reach is the thing that is very compelling for me when I was doing it. But, you know, the thing about the experience, especially for the first few movies that I did that were so, I'm so grateful for also, is that I was working on movies that were big enough to have a very, very large crew and production teams from all over the world, right? So, I mean, I felt more like I was in an international Olympic village than anywhere else. Their sensibilities were different. I didn't feel, for example, like I was in a John Hughes movie, right? Which is very American, I feel, and really
kind of. I don't think you get more, especially growing up in our era, I don't think you get more American teenage life than John Hughes back in the day.
And it captures the milieu perfectly, right? I mean, I think it captures that perfectly. But so, I mean, I didn't feel that. I mean, the first movie I did was The Dark Knight. It felt very international. Second movie I did was 2012, which was, I mean, with a German director, Roland Emmerich, and with a team of people that were also very internationally represented.
I'm trying to think, were you one of the ship captains, not mistaken? My memory's not as bad as my kids say it is.
That movie is, man, that movie was, I mean, it is the mother of all disaster movies. It was great. So, I mean, those were my first few movies, and then Contagion came soon after as well. So, the American experience so far, I think the most American film or series that I've done would be American Born Chinese. I think that really does the deep dive into what it means to be American, what it means to be Asian, what it means to be Asian American. And, by that time I was quite ready for it. I mean, I thought the show had a lot to say about that.
Trying to think, didn't Roland Emmerich do the Independence Day film? Didn't he do that also?
Yes, he did that too. And then I joined him for, so I've done two movies with him now. And I joined him for Independence Day Resurgence, which was another wonderfully, fun movie to be part of.
You were another kind of boss military guy in that, if I remember.
Your memory.
You're on the moon.
Yes, I was on the moon. I just ran into Jeff Goldblum recently, and we kind of reminisced about our time on that film, because he was in it too.
Right.
Yeah. So it was really cool.
Has there been anybody you've interacted with who you've just been like, okay, this is one of the reasons why I have so much joy doing this? Like, Jeff Goldblum is just such an interesting personality. I mean, who is it that you've not only worked with, but maybe you would love to work with, because you're just like, oh my God, this person is just so unique. I just kind of want to be in the same space as them.
Well, I think the Dark Knight was a really kind of a one-stop shop for me, right? With all my heroes, basically. I mean, I got to work with Morgan Freeman, Christian Bale, Gary Oldman.
Plus Heath Ledger and doing that. What a talent.
He's a generational talent, I mean, for sure, I feel, right? I mean, he's so singular and also magnetic and you know, so connected to all his performances. I mean, even as the Joker, which is so out there, I mean, there is something very grounded about him that made the performance work.
Were you like pinching yourself every day came on set and like, I get to be around this, you know, crew of, you know, guys and gals who have, you know, really, yeah. they made the mark, you know?
Yeah. No, but I have to say, I mean, as the euphoria of being cast in the Dark Knight, I remember them flying me out to London on the first day off and then driving me from London 2 hours to Coddington, where they were filming in the giant aircraft hangars from World War II, was so surreal. I think my first stepping on set for the first time with Chris and Emma Thomas was, I think Christian was doing a photo shoot with the Batpod at that point in the bunker. And so it was so surreal. But the euphoria very, very soon gave way to terror because the pressure of performing. I remember my first day on set, the first scene I ever shot was in the prison scene. It was in the prison cell. And we had Aaron Eckhart, we had Chris Nolan, we had Gary Oldman on set. Heath dropped by to say hi, which is very sweet of him. But I remember shooting that on the first day and I was like, gosh, you know, I mean, I have no idea what these guys are thinking. Not sure if they're
I wonder about that. It's because you don't want to be a fanboy, but I think you settle in, okay, I'm at work, I got to do my thing. But at the same time, that as you're saying, the intimidation of the reality of the budget and the actors just kind of starts bubbling up and you start realizing where you are. And that's, it's gotta be exhilarating and scary at the same time. At least it would be for me, I think.
No, it was. And because the shoot was so long too. I mean, they don't even shoot movies for that long now. I think there was a shoot. The shoot days were in excess of 120 days, right? I mean, no movies shoot that long anymore. I think even for big budget films, you're looking at 60 to 70 days. Mm-hmm. And so it was very interesting because I felt like I couldn't relax for the entire duration of it. Of course, I came back and forth and, you know, I was in Chicago for a minute and then they moved the entire company to London and then we were in Hong Kong. So there was a movement. So from around the time of, I think, May, June, all the way to November, December, when I shot my final scene, I was just so highly geared up the entire time.
What do you do when you get off of a film like that? Your last day on the set wraps, you go home. Is it, how long does it take you to kind of spin down from that experience to be able to, because to me, that would be so exciting, so fun. And when you're talking about a blockbuster like that, does it take you a moment to readjust to before you can go jump into another project?
No, totally. I mean, I always take that time out. I know some actors and some friends of mine are, I mean, they have to be working. I mean, they're, you know, I think that's their lifeblood. That's what
right.
Gets them up in the morning. For me, I think I'm happy to do two projects a year or sometimes even one. I do take that moment to decompress. I take a minute to get back to my own self. I mean, otherwise I always feel this, right? I mean, it's different for different actors, but for me, I always feel like one performance can contaminate another performance in a way.
That's okay. See, that's the thing I was thinking about, because you were, depending if you're doing two divergently different type of characters, what is it that kind of recenters you back to you so you can kind of have a fresh slate, you know? And then you look at some characters have a hard time letting go of that character. You see them in interviews, and if they pick up a little bit of an accent or a little bit of a mannerism, it takes them a moment to shake it, I think, which is kind of, you know, hey, they got into it, you know. But I know with Mortal Kombat, you know, one of the guys I'm kind of amazed you had a chance to work with is Carl Urban. That guy's the chameleon of chameleons, you know.
Yeah.
But with this project, I haven't had a chance to see it. But is it a physical thing for you? Have you, you know, is it more of a physical role or?
Yeah, no. The getting into a role, I mean, obviously there are many different entry points for me. Sometimes it's the dialogue, right? Sometimes it's the words. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it is psycho analysis sometimes is as simple as finding the right voice or the right costume for it. And for a movie like that, because it's based off of a video game IP, I think working from outside in was quite useful because, you know, finding the look, finding the hair, finding the armor, finding the kind of pieces, because it helps you move, right? All the, everything that you put on yourself helps you move.
It's kind of like Tom Hanks once said that he doesn't fully get into a role until he puts on the character's shoes from wardrobe. And he said, once he's got the shoes on, he's got the character. And I was like, yeah. Well, that does kind of make sense, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So the entry point for that, I think, is sometimes you work from inside out, sometimes you work from outside in. And I think for that, it is more a physical, the emphasis is more on the physical.
Do you have any kids who you know, they appreciate your work, or are they like, oh, is this dad doing his thing?
I don't have any kids, but I have a lot of nephews and nieces, and they do enjoy movies. They do enjoy movies. I haven't quite asked them what they thought of the roles, some of which are obviously villainous, but you know, okay, I'll do the,
that's got to be fun for you though. Do you still having fun doing that? Because I think it's a chance to express something you can't normally do. To me, I would love to play a bad guy if I was still doing any real acting, but being a bad guy has got to be fun.
being a bad guy is fun. It's definitely fun. I mean, but you know, I also do enjoy, I mean, there were two movies that I played a father in, funny that we're talking about kids, but Final Recipe, which I did with Michelle Yeoh, which is about a family of chefs and cooks, and then American Born Chinese, where I also played a father. I found that particularly gratifying. But coming back to the point of villains, I mean, the moral ambiguity is actually the thing that is that draws me to it, right? I do like the ambiguity of these particular roles. You have to think a bit harder, you know, when you're watching the movie, and you have to kind of...
It's like empathy, isn't it? You really have to have empathy for where that person came from to, I think, properly render a result, you know, I think. Yeah. You can't make judgment calls on them if they're a bad guy, you know.
It helps
is that
me
kind
a lot.
Of the way you approach it?
Well, definitely. And it helps me a lot, obviously, like navigating the highways and the streets of LA with the incredible traffic. very easy to fall into some kind of road rage. But
4:05 is at 3 a.m. one day I was driving going, how is there traffic at 3 a.m.? Never got over that. I was like, how is this possible?
Right. I'm always trying to time it, right? I'm always trying to time it. 2, maybe 3, you never get it. I mean, it's always very, very, very busy.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the thing about the, you know, Michelle Yeoh and doing that and a family of cooks. And that kind of brings me to what I call my 7 questions. I always ask everyone in the first question, because I got to talk food at least once for every episode because it's just fun for me. But the first question I always ask everyone is, what is your favorite comfort food? I mean, if you're having a rough day, it's like, okay, if I have this, it'll make me feel a little bit better. Or a great day, it just kind of adds to it. What's your favorite comfort food?
Oh, it's very simple for me, actually. Rice. Mm-hmm. Any kind of rice, fried rice, steamed rice. There's something about it, right? I mean, that the carbs... I know it's very popular now, the keto diet, the high protein diet, and the low carb diets. But rice is very comforting for me. It actually calms me down. It puts me in a good space. In fact, right after this conversation that we're having, I'm already thinking of this Japanese place that I go to for hand rolls.
You're making me. Here on the island on South Padre Island in Texas, and they have some good restaurants on the island, but it's a tourist zone, you know, 3,000 full-time residents. And then right now we got tons of people pouring in, but it takes an hour to get anywhere. I realize it's been about 2 years since I've had real good sushi. So yeah. I'm like salivating just thinking about really good stuff. But I love the rice.
Yeah. When was the last time you were in LA? I'm constantly amazed by the quality of Japanese food here. It's really.
I was there 2 years ago for an award show. I always got to go to Cantor's Deli, is always a stop station on the cross, Jewish kid. But you know what? I've always wanted to go. There's some Korean places I've wanted to go to there. Right. But there's something in Singapore. What is that ubiquitous thing? It seems basic when you look at it, but it's more dynamic. It's just like it's a boiled chicken or a steamed chicken. It's chicken rice, right?
It's the Hainanese chicken rice. It's the Hainanese chicken rice.
And it looks like it doesn't have a lot of flavor, but from what I understand, it's very flavorful. It's got a lot going on, right?
It's incredibly flavorful. The broth in which they cook the rice in is something that they kind of steam the chicken, and they get that oil.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So they make the rice from the – so that's how they do it. See, that's one thing I love about rice. You can infuse it with all kinds of flavors that way.
And then the choice of the chicken also, I mean, the way that it's prepared, it's so tender, and it's just kind of, you know, soft and tender and flavorful. So, that's Hainanese chicken rice. Speaking of Singapore cuisine, so you have Hainanese chicken rice, you have the chili crabs and pepper crabs,
right. Which are
huge on seafood and a ton of spicy things.
You know, I have a thing I introduce my kids to, and they actually kind of like it, is using Sichuan peppercorn, but not being conservative, using quite a bit, you know, mm-hmm. I always do this right about a time when I haven't had something to eat and I'm making myself hungry. And I'm thinking about thinking of me fondly when you have your wonderful hand rolls today. But the next question I got for you is, if you're going to sit down with three people, living or not, just having coffee, spending an afternoon, talking story, who would those three people be? That you would love to sit down with and share an afternoon with over coffee.
Oh, wow. There's just so many. I would love to pick the brain of Stanley Kubrick. I'm a huge fan of Paul Newman. I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The more I learn about him, the more I like the guy. You know, he's one of those guys just really a mensch, as my people say.
It's very, you know, that they recently had the TV series about him and Joanne Woodward called The Last Movie Stars or something. I think mm-hmm. that's the title of it. And I think he seems like someone who, you know, be nice to spend a time with. I got to spend a little time with Robert Redford on Captain America Winter Soldier. So, I mean, I can only imagine that would just complete the list of people I'd like to spend time with from that era.
You know, the great thing is just watching them talk amongst themselves, I think would make for a, you know, how would they interact with one another? What, you know, because where you kind of feel like a fly on the wall.
Oh, and there's one more I have to mention. Sidney Poitier. I think Sidney Poitier would be an amazing person to chat with.
Just the way he spoke, I think, is just kind of like listening to somebody speak. It's just, you know, sometimes like a Morgan Freeman you spent time with. You just can sit there and talk to him all day. Just talk to me. You know, Sidney Poitier is like that. Now, if you were to go back when you're a young guy, of course, you have this wonderful catalog of things that you were watching when you're young. Got to know, who was your first celebrity crush when you were a kid?
Oh, that's easy. It would be Leah Thompson.
You know, that and Some Kind of Wonderful. That was the one I saw her in. It was like, Leah Thompson, yes. So
the double whammy of Back to the Future and Some Kind of Wonderful happening around the same time was so incredible for me that I even, you know, that I even went to see Howard the Duck a couple of times. So,
you know, especially Mary Stuart Masterson. I mean, you know, just we as kids, we were lucky. We had some great, great folks on film back in the day. Now, if I said to you, okay, Chin Han, you're going to have to live on an island for a year. It's a beautiful island. You love being there, but no streaming. That means if you want to listen to music, you get to bring one CD or maybe a box set. And to watch a movie over and over, you can only bring one DVD. So what would that CD be and what would that DVD be that you could watch over and over for a full year?
Oh, boy. The CD. I think the CD would be Peter Gabriel. I think, is it So?
I was about to say, I think it's So. Yeah, that was his about 88.
I mean, that would be In Your Eyes. That song is from that album, I believe. And movie, well, now you've got me thinking about Some Kind of Wonderful. but I think it would have to be, but I mean, Some Kind of Wonderful and Pretty in Pink, the two of them, I mean, they're kind of like, they're kind of jostling for a top position in terms of John Hughes movies. But I think, you know, I do like Love Actually. I think that's a great, I watched.
That was a good movie, yeah. Multiple storylines that you could follow in that, right?
Yeah, Love Actually kind of, you know, kind of satisfies on a few different levels.
Very good. Well, the next question, God, if you were to... let's say from the time you get up to the time you go to bed, if you said, okay, today was a perfect day, what was a recipe for that day? What were a few of the things that happened in that day to make it perfect for you?
I think a visit to the museum, I think, would be one of them. And then I think followed by a trip to the bookstore. And then
is that a like regular bookstore, or is that like a used, or like it was used bookstores, you know what I'm talking about, like it's yeah. Or is it like a Barnes and Noble kind of a thing?
Okay, so this is interesting, because I mean, I do like used bookstores as well. I don't know if you've been to this one in Portland. I think it's called Powell's, I think. In Portland, that is a gigantic used bookstore. I also like going to the one in LA called the Last Bookstore, but I think that those are new books that they have. I do like the smell of new books. I do like the smell. I don't know how environmentally friendly this is, but I do like the smell of paper very much.
Hey, that's totally normal. You ever go to, like, for me, going to carpet store, fresh new carpet. Like, you know, it's like, I don't know why I like that smell, but yeah, the bookstore, there is a unique smell to a book. And so that aesthetically is, it's one of those things to be calming for some people, I'm sure, you know, cause it's peaceful, you know.
It is peaceful. And then, you know, I also kind of like just wandering. You're just wandering in a bookstore and just picking up books that I've never seen, or writers I've never heard of. It's almost like a, you know, it's like kind of a you know, one of those mystery boxes, if you can call it that, where you just put your hand in and you don't know what you pull out. I like that kind of visit to the bookstore. And then wrapping up the day, with a visit to the theater or the cinema. I think that would be quite complete for me.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, last couple questions. Now, if I was to say, okay, you know, you've had a great career, but right now acting really is not available to you anymore. Mm-hmm. What would be an alternate career or vocation that you would find joy in doing, you think?
I've enjoyed, it's still related to the business. I mean, I've enjoyed directing very much. I mean, I started out in the theater, and there was a period of time when I was directing theater, and that was very fun for me. I mean, I just liked the company of actors, and also, you know, I think the creative aspect of that, I think that would be something I would enjoy. Apart from that, I think the other and creative endeavor, coming back to food, is cooking. I mean, obviously, doing the movie and training for that movie that did acquaint me with all forms of cooking, like street cooking, continental kind of cuisines, and even molecular gastronomy and all that stuff. So, you know, anything that is kind of creative, and you know,
if you were a chef, if I said that was an option, you know, would you have a specific genre, kind of food, a certain technique, something that you feel fits with you and your personality and your style? What would that be?
It's strange. I mean, I'm quite, I think I'm more of an introvert, so I do like quieter things in general. But I have to say the style of cooking that I love is street cooking. Maybe that's in line with Anthony Bourdain's love for, you know, for all the countries that, you know, all the like Southeast Asian countries that he's gone to. Street cooking, I mean, it's so dynamic. It's so robust, you know. I mean, you're cooking with that tens of thousands of BTU, I think, that kind of flame, you know, in the street and with a giant wok. I mean,
people that are just real specialists at one thing and they do it just magically, you know. Yeah.
It seems simple, but it's the right amount of rice wine, it's the right amount of soy sauce, it's the right amount of tossing. And then watching them do it, whether it's in the streets of Hong Kong or Thailand or Singapore, it's like an art form. I always liken it to a dance. So, I mean, I think that would be incredibly fun to do.
Yeah, you look at bookstores the way I look at a big Asian market. Like, I can look at there and go, I don't know what this is exactly, but I know I've seen it before. And it's coming home and just getting a protein and just like figuring it out and start throwing. I think it's wonderful to improvise, but sometimes there is a specificity and only so much of this. And you learn, like, you learn the hard way sometimes. You put too much of one thing in there. It's like, wow, this is way too salty or something. But the improvisation is what's fun to me. But yeah, the street, that's why I want to go to Singapore. From what I understand, there's so many in the markets, the hawker markets, I think is what they call it.
Hawker centers. Yeah.
Now, the last question I got for you, going back to, of course, talking Back to the Future, if you had a DeLorean, you can go back to when you were 16 years old. And you've got a piece of advice. You've got a few minutes to talk to 16-year-old you, to offer a piece of advice to either make that moment of your life a little bit better or to put you on a little different track or something. What would that piece of advice to 16-year-old you be?
I think I think it would be to have come to this career a little earlier, even, I think. I mean, I did start very early, but I think I held off on it for so long, right? I mean, I think I was interested in it as a young child, but I kind of dipped my foot in. I would go for auditions, you know, as a teen with theater companies, maybe get the part and then say no. Or the school play and audition. And I remember auditioning for The Crucible, I remember at the time, and then getting a part in it and then saying no. And I held it off for a long time and until I got my degree, actually, in economics and linguistics at the university. And then finally, I was like, I think now is the time. I think now is the time to really, really just dive in.
Now you have the official degree. Now you gave yourself the freedom to do it, but you're thinking, okay, if you're younger, just go ahead and dive in. You know, that's
there's such a wonderful freedom that only youth can provide.
Exactly. Well, there's something about, like, you know, the naivete of youth probably allows you to do some things you wouldn't do when you know better. You know. But also when you get older, you'd be like, go for it. Why not? You know, but I mean, by the way, I know you got Avatar: Last Airbender.
Yes.
But what else do you have in the pipeline? Are you working on anything else right now or anything you'd like to kind of throw out there?
Well, I'm about to start on a movie called The Big Fix, which is based on a true story about a crime syndicate involved with match fixing in soccer. And that movie also stars Mark Wahlberg and Riz Ahmed. So I'm about to head out, actually very soon, to Australia to start.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. So that's going to be very fun, I think.
Well, Chin Han, thank you so much. It's been honestly more than a pleasure. And I've loved your work and looking forward to enjoying even more of it, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, there you go. Chin Han. Really enjoyed hearing about his journey. Just a cool guy. Everything he's been in, he's just a cool dude in every movie. Sometimes a villain, but always entertaining. And of course, you can check him out in Mortal Kombat 2. Came out not long ago. Also, going back into the library, The Dark Knight, Contagion, American-born Chinese. And, of course, right now on Netflix, you can check him out in Avatar. The Last Airbender Season 2 is on right now. Okay, so that's it for today. But before we go, I want you to please grab your podcast app. It means a lot to me if you could just follow the show, leave a review, like the show. It's just really appreciated, and I thank you very much. And for everything Story and Craft, just go to storyandcraftpod.com. Past episodes, past guests, you know, it's all right there. But I'm going to get on out of here, and I want you to have a great rest of your day. And hey, thank you again. And as I always say, thank you for making what I got going on here part of whatever you've got going on. It means a lot to me. And I'm going to be back with you here soon, just a couple days away, another episode. So come back, and I'll see you then, right here on Story and Craft.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story. Come on.